Street Podcast is made available through the financial contributions of KBCS members. If you haven't already done so, please consider becoming a member of KBCS Community Radio today by going online to our website at kbcs.fm.
Diversity. We give it a voice so you can form an opinion.
40 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. That tragedy sparked the founding of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. Tonight, on Voices of Diversity, we look at the history of the Black Panther Party in Seattle and the nation. What is their legacy and what we can learn from their efforts? Good evening. You're listening to Voices of Diversity, and I'm your host, Onita Harris. On tonight's show, we are reflecting on the 40th anniversary of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. We'll look at its effect on the local Seattle politics and the legacy it has left in the African-American community and beyond. We will also ask these former members of the Black Panther Party on their opinions about what's going on now. First, we are joined on the phone by founder of the National Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, Bobby Seale. Today he's an author and teacher on the black culture. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In the studio tonight, we're also fortunate to have the brothers Aaron Dixon and Elmer Dixon, the co-founders of the Seattle chapter of Black Panther Party. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Bobby Seale, joining us on the phone from Oakland. Tonight, we were talking about the Seattle chapter on the Black Panther Party, but you can begin by why you developed the National Party in Oakland.
Well, the actual National Party had several different levels. I mean, the first, when Malcolm X was killed, which was a year and a half before the Black Panther Party was really founded, I had a one-man riot down the street from my house, and it lasted a quick 10 minutes of me cursing out what I thought was a racist, but I found out the guy wasn't a racist later on. But anyway, what happened is I had to get a new organization going, and I hadn't seen my friend Huey Newton, and I did not know where he lived, and I did know that Richard Aoki, my Japanese friend, knew where he lived, and so I found that out. I went and told Huey that he and I needed to start a new organization. And in effect, you know, Huey was skeptical, it's impossible, black people don't know enough about their history, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. He just got in law school, he really wanted to deal with this law thing now, et cetera, boom, boom, boom. I went and organized a thing called the Black History Fact Group on Merritt College campus. With that, we in effect came up with four different syllabus for four different courses, two courses in African studies and two courses in Black American studies. And then from there, I organized and got our first class set up for that fall, the same year that Malcolm X was killed in Merritt College. And I took the name of the Black History Fact Group and changed it to Soul Students Advisory Council. And from there, I began to organize around in opposition being drafted into the war in Vietnam, that 29% who were dying on the front lines of Vietnam were African Americans, and this country was not recognizing our constitutional democratic civil human right. And from there, I participated in a couple of marches, had a big rally on Merritt College campus, and then we got in a fight with police over a poem I recited up around University of California in Berkeley, and in effect we got arrested, went to jail, got bailed out, went to court in October, and the judge gave us only a 1 year probation each. And then when we came out of the courthouse, I told Huey to meet me at the Warren Poverty Office. I worked for the city government of Oakland at the time, Department of Human Resources, and meet me there that night after everyone was off work, and we were going to finish writing our 10-point program. We did finish the first draft, and in effect, took that program and went to the community and began to ask people and talk to them for a week or two at Merritt College campus and other people, and decided that we was going to move on Point number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people, our black community, of our 10-point program, and begin to patrol and observe police under the law. Huey was in law school at the time. We knew all the laws, all the gun laws, all our rights, et cetera, and had a California Supreme Court ruling that stated we had a right to stand and observe over the police department. So we were within that context, and there we were, wow, capturing the imagination of the people with our law books, tape recorders, and our legal weapons to observe police. And it took 6 months for the California State Legislature to, in effect, put a law in saying no one could carry a loaded weapon. In effect, that within city limits in the state of California, et cetera, and that stopped us from going out because our weapons were loaded. And then, of course, me leading that delegation to the California State Legislature caused several of my party members to get arrested. Well, in fact, 24 of them got arrested. All the men got arrested. They didn't arrest six females.
What were the other points of the 10-point program?
Well, the 10-point program, first point dealt with full employment. One point dealt with full employment. Another point dealt with the need for decent housing. Another point dealt with the need for education that taught us our true history. Another point dealt with an end to the robbery and exploitation of our African-American community. The original 10-point platform of the program that Huey P. Newton and I wrote, number six dealt with all black men and women should not be forced to fight or be drafted to fight in a war in Vietnam since this country does not recognize our constitutional democratic civil human rights. It was later changed to represent free preventative medical health care. And then, of course, then number seven was immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. Number eight was all black men and women who've been tried by all white juries have a right to another trial. Number eight, other fair treatments in the penal legal system. Number nine, and then number 10 was a summary of land, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace. We paraphrased the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, the founding documentation of the United States of America. We stuck that two paragraphs at the tail end and then evolved the United Nations supervised plebiscite to be called to determine the will and destiny of African American people in America. So that 10-point platform and program, that founding documentation, we finished that October, really. We had finished it a bit before October 22nd, but the point is we didn't name it to the actual day of October 22nd. And that's when I went down to the War on Poverty office where I worked for the city government of Oakland and finished the title to the organization. But that's what the 10-point platform and program, the original issues and points of 10 points of what we want and 10 points of what we believe.
Now let's bring it back to Seattle.
Sure.
Aaron Dixon, what happened in Seattle that led to the founding of the Seattle chapter?
Well, like with Bobby, it was Malcolm X. For Seattle, it was the murder of Martin Luther King. Prior to Martin Luther King's assassination, I was incarcerated in the King County Jail along with Larry Gossett and Carl Miller and some other BSU leaders at the University of Washington for a demonstration that we led at Franklin High School and closing down Franklin High School. And then we were arrested on the same day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And we found out about his assassination while we were sitting in the King County Jail. And I think for me at that point, after Martin Luther King was assassinated, I had decided that it was time for myself and for some of the other young activists that we were working with to look for other means of expressing ourselves, other means of getting our point across. And so when we were released from the King County Jail, a week later we went down to San Francisco to the Black Student Union Conference. It was the second West Coast Black Student Union Conference. And while we were at the conference, we heard about a funeral taking place in Oakland, and it was the funeral of little Bobby Hutton, who was the first Panther that was to be murdered by the Oakland police. And so we went over to Oakland, and we went to the funeral. One of the first things we saw was Marlon Brando standing out front with Bobby Seale. Marlon Brando had a leather jacket on and a black beret. We went inside the church and we saw young men and women with their Panther uniforms on, ringing the interior of the church. And we listened to the ceremony, and we saw little Bobby Hutton sitting in his casket. He had been shot about 20 or 30 times by the Oakland Police Department. And then it was a very moving scene. It really touched all of us that were involved. My brother Elmer was with us, and Anthony Ware, and Larry Gossett. And so when we got back to San Francisco State at the conference, we found out that Bobby Seale was coming over to give the keynote address. So we were really very anxious. All of the students were anxious, waiting for Bobby to come. And it seemed like hours. You know, he was supposed to be there like at 6 o'clock, and he probably came about an hour later. But he walked in with Kathleen Cleaver and an entourage of other Panthers, Warren Wells, who had been wounded in that shootout when little Bobby Hutton was killed. And then Bobby began to speak, and I was extremely touched by what Bobby had to say. And to this very day, I have never heard a speech that was as dynamic and as touching as Bobby Seale's speech was that night. It was so touching that as soon as he finished, both my brother and I, though we were standing in different places of the auditorium, we both made a beeline to Bobby Seale, and we told him that we wanted to have a chapter of the Black Panther Party in Seattle. He took our information, and a week later he called and said he was coming up along with George Murray, the Minister of Education, and another Panther comrade, and we met at my parents' house. We met for almost 24 hours, and there were about 25 other young militants from Seattle. Some of them brought their guns over to the house, and we sat and listened to Bobby, and he told us, you know, what the Black Panther Party was about, what Huey P. Newton was about, what was expected of members of the Black Panther Party, and that began the formation of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party.
Thank you. You are listening to the Voices of Diversity. Tonight, we are reflecting on the 40th anniversary of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. Joining us for this discussion are Black Panther Party founder Bobby Seale, as well as the Seattle chapter founders Aaron and Elmer Dixon. We also invite you who are listening to call in with your questions or comments on this tonight's topic. Call 425-564-2424 and give us your input. Now, Mr. Seale, what do you remember of that speech, if anything?
Oh, my God, I've given so many speeches. Normally, what I was doing in those days, my speech entailed what the 10-point platform and program was about. I mean, my speech was like our right to stand and observe the police, why we were doing it, et cetera. I guess all the particulars and the specifics. I have a couple of old KPFA tapes of interviews and some tapes of speeches in my archives, and I have to go back and sit and listen to those to get the old style content, because I mean it was rage time, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I wrote a book called A Lonely Rage, you know, because I guess the loneliness in the jails and the prisons and stuff and fighting, etc. But it was rage time. It was another time. I mean, the Black Panther Party popped up right in the middle of an already ongoing nationwide protest movement. You know, the Seattle chapter evolved right in that time of the time that Martin Luther King was murdered and assassinated in this country. This man was the premier leader of an African-American people's community and of a protest movement that went beyond the African-American people's community. And this is what happened. And I'm just saying, my speech at the time, you know, I remember at Bobby Hutton's funeral, you know, we just finally coined the phrase making reference to police as pigs, you know, at the time. And we had a definition for it, you know, a foul trouters are usually found masquerading as an enemy of, as a victim of an unprovoked attack, but also found to be violating people's constitutional rights without generalized definition. But I gave a speech call that was a hog in the stream. In the stream of water of human liberation, there's a lowlife, just scurvy, racist hog in the screen, dirtying up, messing up, and crapping in the screen, something to that. So you can imagine that we got to remove this hog. It's about phrases in that content, you know.
Elmer Dixon, why did you decide to become part of this movement?
Well, I'll tell you this. In terms of Bobby's speech, you know, there are several segments from that speech that I remember. The word that I would use to describe the speech would be fiery and intense, because it inflamed all of us that were listening. And I think it inflamed people in different ways. I think that many of the students that were there in that room listening to that speech were scared to death after that speech because of what they knew was at stake. And those of us that weren't scared, we were emblazoned to really be ready to die in the next moment, if that were the case. And I think that the commitment level for those people, those of us that joined the party at that night and later on, as we came back and formed the chapter, was that we knew that we were in a struggle and a protracted struggle for liberation, and we were committing our lives. It wasn't a light commitment. You know, I think, 400 or so people joined the party overnight, it seemed like, in Seattle within the next couple of weeks after we came back. But it was very clear by the end of that summer that most of them were going to fade away because they didn't realize the seriousness of the commitment. And so when I think about why I joined, it was a culmination of things. You know, we had grown up, you know, watching the civil rights movement unfold before our eyes on TV. You know, we had a small TV in the TV room, and that probably was a scene that you could see in any number of homes in the 60s. You know, the TV was a relatively new instrument. You know, people used to watch or sit around their radios and listen to radio shows in the previous generation. This was the first generation where the news was brought to you in your living room, and we could see that the demonstrators, the freedom riders that had gone to the South to ask or demand for their God-given rights to be able to sit, you know, on a toilet seat or drink out of a fountain of water or ride a bus or enjoy the freedoms that others had enjoyed in this country, and we were denied because of the color of our skin. And you could see that these freedom fighters, both black and white, were being beat by policemen, were being hosed by firemen, and these were the people that were supposed to protect and defend us. And after years of seeing that and then watching leader after leader, first Malcolm get assassinated, we had Medgar Evers was assassinated, you know, Martin Luther King, that was just the culmination of things. And the rage was building in black America. You know, you remember that in 1965, you know, when the same year, ironically, that the Civil Rights Act was passed into law, you know, the Detroit riots broke out, the Watts riots broke out. This was a culmination of black people that were, and in particular young black people that were, you know, they were just frustrated with the way that our rights were being trampled on and ignored. So it wasn't any single event for me. It was the culmination of all of those things. And when we got to Oakland and we saw, I mentioned in another interview that the first sight I remember when we got off the bridge, Bay Bridge, coming across from San Francisco and getting driving right down into West Oakland, was that there were hundreds of black people standing on the streets. And I remember thinking to myself, my God, this looks like a black army. And it soon became clear that they were organizing into an army of black people to stand up for the rights of the black community. And the speech, you know, let me just say that seeing Bobby Hutton's body in the coffin, he was 17 years old. I was 17 at the time, and I remember thinking that could be me lying there. And so there was a connection there right away, instantly, with, you know, what was happening in not only the Bay Area but around the country. And so when we heard Bobby speak, you know, it was the fieriness of that speech. I remember Bobby, you saying specifically, until their blood runs in the street. You know, if our blood is going to be let, their blood runs in the street. And it was a time of rage, but it was controlled rage, because we knew we had a protracted struggle that we had to organize people and really get them to understand what it took, you know, to really go out and commit yourself to a life of struggle.
Aaron, what were the issues you took on?
Well, I think the first issues that we really took on were the issues of police brutality, because as in Oakland, as in many other urban communities throughout the country, the police departments were waging war against the black community, and many young people were oftentimes the victims of this war that was being waged. And so we began to organize community patrols of the police and beginning to confront the police when they were arresting someone unjustly or whenever they were acting in an unjust manner. So, you know, we're really focusing on those community issues. But, you know, ironically enough, when we first opened our office up, we began to get calls from the community for all types of problems and all types of issues, whether we got calls from families that were having problems with landlords. We had a call from one family. There was a family of about 7 children and their mother and a single mother, and the landlord had taken the door off their house. And so they called us, and we sent Panthers to retrieve the door. They went and got the door and put the door back on its hinges and put it back on the house. We also got calls from young women or older women who were having problems with their boyfriends or their husbands. They were getting beat up, and we sent Panthers over there to straighten that out. So we were really acting in for the benefit of the community, and you know there were a wide variety of things that we were focusing on. But our main issue that we were focusing on in those early years was the issue of police brutality.
Tonight we're talking about the history of the Seattle Black Panther Party. I'm Anita Harris. In the studio with me is Black Panther Party founder Bobby Seale, as well as Seattle chapter founders Aaron and Elmer Dixon. What do you think of the work of the Panthers? Join this discussion. Call 425-564-2424. Bobby Seale, how was this similar or different from the other issues you were facing in Oakland?
I was what similar? What do you mean?
How was the issues that you faced in your chapter of the Black Panther Party different or similar from the Seattle chapter?
Quite similar. I mean, we wound up ourselves dealing with landlord problems, various other kinds of problems in the community. You know, just police literally running in people's houses in those early days, and we would be on the spot. I mean, Denzel Dow in North Richmond, I mean, this party was probably, 4 months old, and a family out there called us out about him being shot and killed, and he was shot over 10 times. That, in effect, led us to go and try to talk to the DA downtown about the clothing, et cetera. You know, we wanted information from them about Denzel Dow's killing, and, of course, there was a borderline. North Richmond was outside of the city limits of Richmond, California, and it was under the purview of the county seat of the Contra Costa County. And in effect, it caused us to go to the Martinez, to the county, to talk to the sheriff. And then that, in effect, caused us, when we heard that State Assemblyman Mulford, representing Oakland, California, was putting a bill in to try to stop Black Panther Party members from carrying loaded weapons within city limits. They didn't want to infringe upon hunters' rights outside of city limits. But within city limits, within 150 feet of public property, and public property included all roadways, byways, and sidewalks, then, you know, we went up there to protest that. And it was 24 Black Panther Party members, May 1st, 1967, that we went there, and I read the statement, the first, what we call the executive mandate number one from the Black Panther Party, about the repression, about the history of the internment Japanese people in the internment camps, et cetera, and how this fitted into the whole context of the continued oppression, and that they were renovating those camps, possibly even for black people today, because we was in such a rage at that period and that time. So our issues were the same, you know what I mean? If you went from city to city, I mean, later we evolved the free preventative medical health care clinics, I mean, which all chapters and all branches moved to put those up, you know. Then I came in and we kicked out the free breakfast for children programs, particularly in the fall of 1968, or when school got started in 1968. And that program spread across the country. Following Martin Luther King's death, chapters and branches of the Black Panther Party in the next 7 to 8 months into the end of the year evolved to 49 chapters and or branches, offices operating in various cities throughout the United States of America. And you're talking about a big, grosser amount of what we call 5,000-plus Black Panther Party members. Now, half of them were rally Panthers, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The other half were working Panthers, you know what I mean? They were dedicated. Many a young folks who were in college that summer following the death of Martin Luther King came to work in the Black Panther Party, to be part of the Black Panther Party. And then when the fall came, I mean, we were still in shootouts and other situations, Free Huey Newton and all kind of organizing. A lot of those people, students and young folks, did not go back to college that fall. And many of them put 3, 4, 5, and 6 years in the party. And nowadays, sure, I can talk to you about 1,000-plus or more bunch of PhDs and master's degree former Black Panther Party members, but it was those programs that we put up, you know, that really solidified, plus various attacks and shootouts was just still occurring in various different kinds of ways and the way the police was operating. And by 1969, the FBI was in on the planning of the killing and the attacking of Black Panther Party officers. I mean, and through the year of 69, my God, every Black Panther Party office on one level or another got either attacked or confronted by police in one way, shape, fashion, form, or another. And that resulted in some chapters and branches in different shootout situations, you know. And what happens here is that we wound up getting a lot of political prisoners. We wound up getting some party members just going underground and leaving the country, going to Canada, going abroad, in those kind of situations. And when that breakfast program spread so broad, we was getting so much. Next thing you know, J. Edgar Hoover was on television for the second time. This time he was saying the Black Panthers' Free Breakfast for Children program was a threat to the internal security of America. So, I mean, you can imagine the dynamic of what was happening there. I mean, we was on every level of issues, et cetera, the coalition politics. I mean, the coalition politics of the Black Panther Party, I remember with all the retreats we had, et cetera, clocking, and some 38 different organizational groups that the Black Panther Party cross-coalesced with, you know, including SDLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, working with Dr. Reverend Ralph Abernathy following the death of Martin Luther King and so on. I mean, whether you were Asian, you know, young progressive white, et cetera, or whoever, you know what I mean, young poor whites, I think the young patriots and others, I think they first coalesced in Seattle there with the Black Panther Party, with Aaron and Elman and others. But my point is that dynamic of the Black Panther Party spread across the country, and it was a stand-up position of saying that we were standing for our constitutional, democratic, civil, human rights. We standing for our human liberation. And if you take away all of these other free speech rights or whatever other kind of rights, et cetera, I used to say that if you take away those constitutional rights as enumerated in the Constitution of the United States of America, then we, the people, will organize guerrilla units to take back our constitutional rights. I mean, that's how far I went to say to call for guerrilla warfare if you just outright fascists begin to mow down the people, then there is no people's government. There is no people's liberation, you know. So whether you was white, black, blue, red, green, yellow, or polka dot, this is the thing that evolve in the real sense, because peaceful white protesters was being attacked, shot, and killed, and brutalized, you know, and they begin to see. I mean, a lot of young white kids was getting their first understanding, police brutality 101, you know what I mean? in that period, you know. So they begin to say, hey, wait a minute, the Panthers is right. They got a right to defend themselves.
Elmer, describe what was going on in Seattle at that time.
Well, we were, in fact, the organization that at Central Headquarters really, laid a clear path for us. And we, it was our objective to go out and find out, what the community really needed. We had organized block captains and block patrols, and we knew that organizing the free breakfast programs was a priority, after we had initially started with the police alert patrols and responding to various needs and requests. We had to have an organized approach. And so we ended up with eventually having 5 free breakfast programs in Seattle that covered all of the major housing projects as well as some of the areas in the central community. We formed a free medical clinic, which was first called the Sidney Miller Free Medical Clinic and later became the Carolyn Downs Family Medical Center, which ironically is still in operation today. We had a busing to prisons program that went to all of the state's 5 prisons. We did that on a monthly and sometimes weekly basis. We actually took busloads of students from the University of Washington into the state prisons, particularly in Monroe, Washington, to organize college education programs to get those young men and women prepared to come back out and be able to deal effectively in society. We highlighted the sickle cell anemia plight of black people as well as blood pressure levels and did blood pressure screening programs and sickle cell anemia screening programs, started some of the first free food banks in the Seattle area. So I often hear people talk about the Black Panther Party, and they seem to those that weren't there or were on the periphery forget, what the program, what the party was all about. Our survival programs were about teaching people within the community that they could, in fact, control the resources within their community to meet their own needs. We used to have one of our many phrases or slogans, if you will, in those days was use what you got to get what you need. And we knew we had resources within the black community that could really sustain us, And I think that one of the legacies that we continue to leave behind and people continue to discover is that a lot of the programs that you see running in Seattle and other parts of the country around the U.S. were programs that were instituted initially by the Black Panther Party. We talked about education that met our the needs of our kids. There's a well-known black school, Zion Prep Academy, that formed around the time that we were running our summer, what we called our summer liberation schools. We actually, in at Central Headquarters in Oakland, founded the Oakland Community School, which is, I believe, one of the first free standing and incorporated black schools in the Bay Area. So we really were not only just serving the needs of the community, but we were basically role models and laying the example for how we could control the resources within our community and not ask the government for our needs, but also meet our own needs.
Elmer, what was your relationship with the community at large?
What was my relationship with the community?
Mm-hmm.
I think, I'm assuming that you're asking that in a larger sense in terms of the Black Panther Party.
Yes.
I think that they saw us as their really. We used to talk about being the vanguard. Really the one organization that stood on the principle that the poor and disenfranchised people of the community needed someone to be their voice. And the poor and disenfranchised, the people that were the forgotten souls, the people that had no representation, the people that didn't have someone looking out for them, they saw us as their defenders. They saw us as their protectors. They saw us as people that would stand on principles and not be bought out. They saw us as the ones who could be their voice. When in fact times were hard, They knew that we would speak up for them, and people always knew that and respected that. You know, we're still approached today. I know Aaron and I are, and Bobby probably is in Oakland, and probably many Panthers across the country are approached by young people who thank us for providing, you know, breakfast for them so that they could, you know, focus on their education, or for sticking up for their rights, or for giving them an opportunity to succeed. You know, we really laid a foundation for people to say, you know, we can be proud of who we are and proud of our community, and we know that somebody's got our back.
Tonight we're talking about the history of the Seattle Black Panther Party. I'm Anita Harris in the studio with Black Panther Party Bobby Seale, as well as the chapter founders Aaron and Elmer Dixon. What did you think of the work? Join the discussion, 425-564-2424.
Colors Northwest Magazine and ColorsNorthwestCareers.com support KBCL along with our listeners. ColorsNorthwestCareers.com is a website where professional and managerial candidates of color search for companies looking for candidates to join their teams. ColorsNorthwestCareers.com and Colors Northwest Magazine are your diversity resources for career and news.
I'm not needing my hand. You know all the work I did before the other man. Now we the man that can do things for ourselves. We're tired of beating our head against the wall and working with someone else. Say it now. Say it now. Say it now. Say it now.
This is KBCS Community Radio. We are here on Voices of Diversity. We are talking about the history and legacy of the Seattle Black Panther Party. I want to call out to the ladies. Were you involved in the Panthers? We want to hear from you. Please call 425-564-2424. Bobby Seale, you were approached by Reverend Ralph Abernathy of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Tell me about that.
No. Reverend Ralph Abernathy was SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Dr. Martin Luther King. He called me 6 weeks before Martin Luther King was killed and asked would we, the Black Panther Party, be willing to participate in a roundtable representing 100 or more organizations across the United States of America, one, to hammer out, or first, to identify all the issues, programs, problems that each and every organization was about and dealing with, and then two, to work together to hammer out a practical economic goal objective, you know what I mean, for as that related to our liberation. And of course, as chairman of the Black Panther Party, I said, definitely, we would definitely participate. And of course, we also participated, you know, from there with the Poor People's March program that Dr. Martin Luther King had planned before he was assassinated. And, of course, we packed the Oakland Auditorium here alone, and other chapters and branches worked to help that program. So, I mean, yes, you know, that was some of our coalition politics that in crossing organizational lines. You know, and that's the way the party was. If you were progressive, practical, et cetera, and understood what human liberation was about, we related to that, you know. That's one of the great characteristics about the Black Panther Party. And you see, the falsity of what the FBI and the counterintelligence program did was they put it out that we hated all white folks, even in the face of our coalitions with young white left radicals all across the country, you know. I mean, Mayor Daley of Chicago in 1968 was on national television saying the only reason the Black Panther Party members had guns was to come into the white community and shoot and kill white people, which was just the total opposite of what we were about. Because when you read now, when I read them 20-odd years ago, the Freedom of Information Act documents dealing with the FBI's counterintelligence program against us, the Black Panther Party, you will see how they sent press releases to the politicians in all the cities where Black Panther Party members operated out of, and how they sent this counterintelligence program and to propagate this disinformation. And they sent these press releases not only to the press, they sent them to the offices of the politicians. And in effect, Mayor Daley in Chicago took the lead, you know, on a national television program saying that we were there to kill and shoot all white folks, which was a disinformation campaign on their part. So, I mean, there was all other kind of disinformation efforts on the part of the FBI because, you know, the final analysis of the FBI, we document and show now with those counterintelligence program documents that the FBI was complicit in the murder and the killing of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark December the 4th, 1969 in Chicago, Illinois. We also show that there was complicity in the killing of Alprentice Bunchicotta and John Huggins at University of California, Los Angeles, in the January of 1969, the first part of that year. But Dr. Reverend Ralph Abernathy and many, many other progressive people, black, white, blue, red, green, yellow, polka dot, we work with, you know, and it was important that that synergetic slogan, all power to all the people, you know, and no more power to the avaricious, racist, corporate money, rich class, who are controlling the political institutions, including the police departments, et cetera, you know, to perpetuate this oppression that we are subjected to.
What was the role of women in the National Party?
They were two-thirds of all membership in the Black Panther Party. I used to call retreats of all chapters and branches, send a portion of your leadership down. And I think four, five, or six retreats in late 68 and early 69, in that period. And I had a large map on the wall of all the chapters and all the branches. You know, some people say, oh, it was only 26. No, and to include the branches, it was 49. And my point is that women were just a great part of that growth. I remember following Martin Luther King's death, Charles Brunson, a young black man in Sacramento, ex-military personnel, United States Air Force, but he was a male man, but he was connected with the community college there. He calls me up. He says, Chairman Bobby Steele, I'm Charles Brunson, the Sacramento chapter of the Black Panther. I said, we don't have a chapter in Sacramento yet. Well, sir, I said, if you want to do that, come down here to Oakland and we'll get it out. Next thing I know, somebody called me at my house 2 days later and says, Bobby, better get out here. Some guy's marching all these people down the street. I drove the car over there. They have half the street blacked off, and this man is marching almost 80 people, about seven or eight of them maximum was male. The rest of them was all female. Short ones in the front all the way to the tall ones in the rear, all in black skirts, black stockings, black bush jackets, black berets, blue scarves, etc., marching in correct, exact military cadence. I mean, I know that because I was 4 years in the United States military, how exact and good it was. It blew my mind. And I walked up in my old nappy head, bad beaded hair with my big .357 Magnum in the back under my coat and whispered to Charles Brunson. He's standing at attention to me, saying, purporting his heart, sir. And I says, hey, look, brother, I says, why don't you dismiss your troops? He says, no, sir. He says, I can't do that. I told him that you were there, you're going to inspect them, et cetera. So I says, oh, okay, I see what you're talking about. He says, they're here for an inspection. I says, okay, Joe, open the ranks and dress them up. And I inspected this group, and then, boom. But I'm just, these were female, but what I told them and got them to understand after the PE session, y'all got either start a free sickle cell anemia testing program or a free breakfast program, and I'll come up in a couple, 2 or 3 weeks to see you, what you guys are doing. So, well, in a week's time, they had both a free sickle cell anemia program. So the fervor of the youth and the women as organizers, you know, and you have to see the women in the beginning of the party because, what, we were 7 months old, and Kathleen Cleaver, she was on the Central Committee, the leadership body of our organization, the Black Panther Party, in those early days when the party was only 7 months old. But that developed to a point where people like Sister Audrea Jones, really now known as Dr. Dunham, Dr. Audrea Dunham, she organized and ran the whole Massachusetts state chapter of the Black Panther Party. So sisters and as females, as political revolutionaries, were an immediate part, I mean, in the real growth of the party. I mean, when I talk about that 5,000 membership by the end of 1968, two-thirds of them were black females.
Eventually, Elaine Brown was the head of the party. Aaron Dixon, you worked closely with her. What was that like?
Well, it was a time of a changing period for not just America, but for the Black Panther Party as well. And that was one of the significant things of the Black Panther Party, because we were ordered to read 2 hours a day. We were given a book list of over 20 books. We participated in what was called ideological institutes. So we were always changing, and Elaine Brown came to the leadership of the party at a very crucial time when the party had undergoing some very serious changes. And she was a very very bright, very intelligent woman, very dynamic woman who helped to redevelop and rebuild the Black Panther Party and establish some very important coalitions and connections within the city of Oakland. And it was a very short period of time before the Black Panther Party was actually running the city of Oakland. We had elected Lionel Wilson to become mayor of Oakland. He was a good friend of Huey's. We had asked him if he wanted to run for mayor. We ran his campaign, and we actually put him in the mayor's office. And once he became mayor, Elaine Brown was in the mayor's office pretty much telling him how to run the city. As a result of him being elected, two Panthers were appointed to the Port of Oakland, and these were women that were appointed to the Port of Oakland. And we looked at the Port of Oakland as being and a very, very important part of a very important institution that we felt we had to have some control over. So we had also developed a relationship with Jerry Brown, who was the governor of California at that time. So it was a very Elaine Brown was a very dynamic person who was very dedicated to the party. And she became one of the most powerful persons in the state of California during that period.
Aaron, what would you have done differently, and how did the Black Panther Party change you?
Well, I don't know. I think I was only 19 at the time when I became defense captain, and I was learning on the fly. And while I was learning on the fly, there were a lot of things that were happening in terms of attacks that were being targeted against the Black Panther Party. I think in the first year, we lost three party members. And so going to funerals came a very important part of our life. I think probably what I maybe could have done differently was to scrutinize the people that we let into the party, because the party became heavily infiltrated in many different chapters and branches, and the Seattle chapter became quite infiltrated. Some of the deaths that we had were a result of that infiltration, and I myself was almost killed on several occasions because of that, and eventually almost had my arm blown off because of that infiltration. So I think that's one of the things I think we all would change, is we would have been a lot more careful and had screened who we let into the Black Panther Party to make sure that there were no FBI informants and police informants to cause some of the disruption that took place. And I would say that it changed me. I was a different person by the time I left the Black Panther Party. I was not the quiet, shy person that I was when I joined the party. I think that I was had become very disillusioned when the party ended, I pretty much had the same commitment that I had when I joined the party, but it changed me tremendously.
Elmer, describe to me the Rainier Beach incident.
Aaron, why don't you describe the Rainier Beach incident?
Okay, the Rainier Beach incident probably was one of the defining moments of the Seattle chapter, and it happened about a month after the chapter had been formed. Rainier Beach was an all-white high school at the time. We're talking about May, the end of May. We got a call from a Black mother who said that her son had been beaten up by white students at Rainier Beach High School, and the principal refused to do anything about it. I had just gotten a call, and she wanted us to come out there and do something. I had just gotten a call from Chairman Bobby, and he said that, Aaron, I want you guys to quit acting like the police, because you can't respond to everything that the community asks you to respond to, because I was sending down weekly reports. And so I told her that, you know, we couldn't come out to Rainier Beach. So, but she called back Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. She called back Friday. She was crying. She said that there were white students had bought guns and bats and sticks to school and were threatening the Black students. We got three or four more calls from Black mothers. There happened to be about 13 Panthers sitting in the office. Everybody had their rifles and shotguns, because we carried our rifles and shotguns everywhere we went. And so we decided it was time for us to go out to Rainier Beach. So we loaded in our cars and drove through the Lake Washington Boulevard to Seward Park until we got to Rainier Beach. There were about 30 police officers standing out on the side. We got out of our cars with our weapons and headed across the street, and we were confronted by a fat sergeant who came up to me and said, Dixon, you can't take those loaded weapons inside. And we knew him because we had had many confrontations with him before. I told him that the weapons weren't loaded, which they were loaded, but there wasn't a bullet in the chamber. And we were taught that if the bullet was not in the chamber, it's considered unloaded. So we marched into the building. We saw the principal. He saw us, and he took off running down the hallway. I dispatched two comrades to go get him. They brought him back, and we took him to the office and sat him down. And he was, of course, very visibly shaken. You got 13 armed Panthers in black leather jackets standing over. So I told him if he didn't start protecting those kids, that we were going to protect them. And he promised from now on that he would make sure that the Black students were protected. So we went outside, and we backed our way to the car, because we were taught very early on that Huey said, you never turn your back to the pigs. So we got in our cars, and we drove back to the community. The police followed us. We got a call from our attorney that said that the police were preparing indictments against us, but those indictments never came. And as I said, that was really the defining moment of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party.
Aaron, what did you personally learn about political organizing?
Well, I learned so much about political organizing. I learned Bobby was an organizational genius, and he really taught us well in terms of how to organize and how to have that intensity. I think one of the most important things that we learned in the party about organizing was that an obstacle was merely something to overcome. There was nothing really anything that stopped us. You know, a Panther getting killed, our office getting raided. I remember one of the offices in the Midwest getting raided and getting burned down. And they called Oakland and they said, Bobby, our office got burned down. He said, well, open it back up. And that was the mentality that we had. We had nothing that could stop us in terms of what we were doing. And we also understood that that slogan, use what you got to get what you need. We started the breakfast programs with nothing, no government funding, because we had orders from central headquarters that no Black Panther Party chapter branch could take federal funding. So, I mean, we ran over, there were 62 programs in total, but in those early years, we had at least 10 different programs that we were running in Seattle. We had no government funding. We had a cadre of 20 to 25 Panthers, and we were just doing just amazing amount of work. You know, from the time we woke up at 6 in the morning till the time that we went to bed at 2 o'clock at night, we lived, breathed, and slept the people and the Black Panther Party.
Elmer, how did the party change you as a person?
But you know, I think that it kind of galvanized what I think our parents taught us very early in life, that you never judge a person by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And Bobby spoke about the various coalitions that we had in the Black Panther Party. We grew up in a neighborhood that was quite diverse. In fact, I live today in a zip code that is the most diverse zip code in the United States. And so we grew up with Japanese, Chinese, Latino, Native American, white, black, all kind of people that grew up around us. And the party, even though we were really the as I said earlier, the vanguard of the black community, we did that in coalition with all of these other communities. And in fact, Fred Hampton coined the phrase Rainbow Coalition. That didn't come from Reverend Jackson, by the way. No disrespect to Reverend Jackson, but that was part of our whole being. And so as I emerged from the Black Panther Party and began to build my own life with my family, I continue to carry those ideals into the work that I do. In making sure that regardless of what color you are or what gender you are or what sexual orientation you are, that you have a fair shake in life. And so those were ideals that came from our parents that were just galvanized by the Black Panther Party.
Bobby Seale, in less than 1 minute, can you tell us what the legacy of the Black Panther Party will be?
Grassroots, programmatic, relevant community organizing. That is true, because for a black community organization, for an organization that evolved out of the African-American community, some of the organizing feats that the Black Panther Party members put together in all these various chapters and branches, it hasn't been repeated lately or recently. You see what I'm getting at? So that is the true, profound legacy. Yes, we stood up for our constitutional, democratic, civil, human rights, and we wouldn't take no crap from any racist, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. But the bottom line was organizing the people on a grassroots level. That was what was the true legacy.
Well, we have come to the end of our program. We want to thank each of our guests tonight, Black Panther Party founder Bobby Seale, as well as Seattle chapter founders Aaron and Elmer Dixon. You've been listening to the discussion on the legacy of the Black Panther Party in Seattle. Two events this weekend will commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Seattle Black Panther Party. Friday, April 25th at 6 p.m., an opening reception is scheduled to take place at the Northwest African American Museum. Also on Saturday...
Actually, that location has been changed to Seattle University at Casey Building.
Thank you very much. Also on Saturday, April 26th at 1 p.m., there will be events at the Yesler Terrace Community Center. And for more information about these events, they are available on the Voices Diversity Program page, KBCS-FM. I'm Anita Harris. Engineer was Kevin Morris, and technical producer was Kenny Schoenfeld. Helping in the studio was Dave Griffith. For an archive of this evening's program and links to our guest information we discussed this evening, check out Voices of Diversity program on page KBCS-FM. If you have any questions or comments, email us at news@KBCS-FM. Tune in next week for the discussion about women in the trades. Stay tuned for Mary Beckwith, the final Woman's Notes show, coming up next here on KBCS 91.3 FM, Bellevue, Seattle. For Voices of Diversity, I'm Onita Harris.
This free podcast is made available through the financial contributions of KBCS members. If you've not done so already, please consider becoming a member of KBCS Community Radio today by going online to our website at kbcs.fm.
This recording is property of KBCS 91.3 FM Community Radio and Bellevue Community College. All rights reserved.